We're in this story from Mark chapter 6. That's the feeding of the 5,000. Now, if you're like me, I grew up in Sunday school and hearing lots of Bible stories. I was in church most of my life. I felt like during the week we were there a lot. And one of the techniques back in the kind of 70s, 80s that they would use to teach children in Sunday school was what was called flannel graph. How many of you are familiar with flannel graph? Put your hand up. How many of you are unfamiliar with flannel graph? Okay, so about half and half. And so the idea of flannel graph is that there's kind of these little, I don't know what's on the back of them, some kind of stickiness, flannel, I guess, flannel or graph or something on the back of it. And it would stick to these felt boards. And so a lot of times teachers would use that as a tool to teach stories from the Bible. And so all these stories would have kind of a flannel graph set that went with it. And for some reason, the few stories that stand out in my mind of seeing flannel graph, one of them was the story of Jesus teaching the 5,000. So there was always this kind of long-haired, brown-haired, white, sissified-looking Jesus that would be put up on the board. And if the flannel graph set's been used very long, right, Jesus is probably missing a hand, or they're trying to put the hand up near where it's supposed to go. And then he would have some awkward kind of loaf, and then could never really represent 5,000 people on the flannel graph board. So there would just be this kind of awkward group of people over on the side. But the idea was to teach, and then there would be these little, you know, little loaves of bread, little fish, and then some little kid with a basket that gave it to Jesus. And so that was kind of the flannel graph version of this most popular, one of the most popular stories in all of the Gospels. One of the few stories here, and this is why it made the flannel graph set, this is one of the few stories that's included in all four Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John include the feeding of the 5,000. So that lets us know, like, this is an important story. Not only is it one of the most popular, but what it teaches has to be something that needs to be emphasized and highlighted, because it makes it into all four narratives, all four of the Gospel writers. So again, let's kind of put this in context. Back in verse 30 of chapter 6, we're introduced to the story. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all they had done. Again, this is coming off of his commissioning of them. And they went out and they taught and they performed miracles, and they come back to Jesus. And again, I emphasized last week, this was our last verse in the text last week, the disciples want to make note of what they had done and taught. And verse 31, and he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place," there's that word again, "desolate place by themselves. Now when many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them." So let me again put this in context. Jesus has just learned of John the Baptist's execution. Now, we saw the arrest and execution of John the Baptizer last week. If you parallel this with Matthew's gospel, Matthew tells us that Jesus learns of the execution of Jesus, of John, right before this takes place. And so, again, this is his cousin. This is his forerunner in ministry. You can imagine the grief that Jesus is experiencing. He's feeling drained from all this teaching and this preaching tour and in and out of these small villages. And then he learns that John has been executed. And so the disciples have returned from their mission. They are exhausted. And so Jesus and the disciples, they want to withdraw. They want to pull back, right? They're peopled out. You ever been peopled out? It doesn't take much for me to get there, I want to be honest with you. But peopled out, that's where Jesus and his disciples are. They're peopled out, and so they're just like, hey, we're going to withdraw. We're going to rest. The crowds are pressing Jesus and his disciples, the text says, to the point they don't even have time to eat. That's a bad day. If you are so busy you can't even eat, that's a bad day. Now, I don't know if they had like Luna bars and Kind bars and all those kind of stuff that you could just pull out, right, and snack on. I don't know if they had fruit snacks is the word I was looking for. Fruit snacks, you know, Levi wants us to have a constant supply of fruit snacks on hand. So whenever they're in, I mean, fruit snacks are in demand at my house, right? Like, and now it's to the point he's just like opening the box himself, getting out 5 packs of fruit snacks. Like, dude, slow your roll. Like, dinner's in 7 minutes. You can't be eating 17 packs of fruit snacks. But there's not even time to eat with Jesus and his disciples. And so Jesus says to them, like, come away. And the emphasis of the text here, come away by yourself to a desolate place. They need to withdraw in order to recover. Let me pause here to say, we've seen this in Mark's gospel, and I want to take us back to the beginning of when Jesus called the disciples. The top priority of the disciple of Jesus is to be with Jesus. To be with Jesus. Top priority for the disciple, for the follower of Jesus. Top priority is to be with Jesus. Your top priority as a disciple of Jesus, a follower of Jesus, is to spend time with Jesus. To be with Jesus. And so Jesus says, let's pull back, right? Because we've been in the middle of ministry business, like, right? The logistics of ministry, figuring all this stuff out. And we've been in the middle of ministry busyness, right? So it's the kind of business side of ministry and the busyness side of ministry. And Jesus says, you're exhausted. I'm grieving. I'm exhausted. Let's pull back. Let's rest. And let me make the statement, the greater the demands of ministry, the more our need to be with Jesus. The more busyness, the more business of serving, giving, contributing, investing in ministry, the more our need to be with Him. But as we've seen throughout Mark's gospel, the crowds will not leave Jesus alone. And so they follow Him to this remote area. Crowds are a constant obstacle. Obstacle to the cross-centered, cross-focused ministry of Jesus. We love crowds, right? Seems like particularly the American church is all about the crowd. A lot of times in the Gospels, crowds are not a positive thing. Crowds stand in the way of Jesus' cross-centered mission. And we kind of see it here again. They're trying to rest. They're trying to recuperate. They're trying to be focused on the task. And this crowd is just pressing in. So it's important how Jesus responds to this crowd. They're interrupting His time of rest. Once again, they're standing kind of as an obstacle. If Jesus is like me, this is not going to be a happy moment for me. Right? I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be frustrated. I'm just trying to rest and you're pressing in. And so how Jesus responds to this crowd is extremely important. It kind of pulls back His heart and allows us to see that. How does Jesus respond in 34? When He went ashore, He saw a great crowd. And He got frustrated and told them to go away. He got angry because they didn't have time to rest. He got back in the boat and went back to the other side. No, it's none of that, right? He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And He began to teach them many things. Now, the word crowd here that Mark uses, a great crowd, is a different word than the word he normally uses for crowd. The word crowd here has a male emphasis. We see that in the verse 44 at the end of this text, that there were 5,000 men, Mark highlights, that there were 5,000 men. So why is he using a different word? Why does he seem to be emphasizing men here? Well, scholars believe there's a couple of options. Option number one is probably what most of us grew up hearing, is that the men kind of represented the house, the head of the household in this patriarchal culture. And so the head of the household, there were 5,000 men. And then if you add to that, right, women and children, that this crowd size could have been 10, 15, 20,000 people. That's a very common interpretation of what's going on here. A different interpretation that some scholars believe is that he's emphasizing men because the idea of men here is that these guys were kind of freedom fighters. They were zealots. The desert, the wilderness, is where men would retreat to rally the troops, right? Remember who the zealots are? They're the guys that want to overthrow Rome by violence if necessary, right? They're the freedom fighters. They're the guys that are like, let's get the troops together, let's invade Rome, let's overthrow. Now let's put this in context, and it kind of helps us see what's going on here. If these guys are kind of this freedom fighters group, these zealots, they've rallied around Jesus to this remote area. Why? Because they are revolution-minded. Let's overthrow. Let's conquer. Think about it. John the Baptizer just killed. Was John the Baptizer a popular guy? Absolutely. Crowds flooded into the desert to hear him, right? He was kind of the guy that a lot of these zealots rallied behind. Like they thought John was the guy who was going to set off this invasion of Rome. And so John the Baptist has been killed. John has pointed to Jesus as this Messiah. Messiah for them was very political. And so this political Messiah has arrived, and they have this political Messiah agenda. John's gospel, and here's where most scholars will allude to for this interpretation, John, in his recording of this story, says that those that were in the desert wanted to, listen, force Jesus to become their king, to make him king. See what's going on here? This is the guy we can rally behind. Freedom fighters thinking, he's our guy. Let's make him king. So while we tend to picture this as kind of a picnic in the wilderness, there's a lot more going on here. A lot more going on of what they are expecting of Jesus. And so the reaction of Jesus here is telling. It lets us know who he is. Despite being interrupted from their much-needed rest, the text says Jesus responds with compassion. And this word compassion is a word in the New Testament that is only used of Jesus. That is a deep-seated kind of gut reaction. This compassion that is natural to him, this deep-seated emotion. And then this language is used. He sees them as sheep without a shepherd. This language takes us back into the Old Testament. It takes us to Numbers 27. It's in Numbers 27 that God transitions the leadership of Israel from Moses to Joshua. Do you remember the story? We don't have time to dig into it. You can go back and read that text after the fact. But due to his disobedience, Moses is not going to be allowed to lead God's people into the promised land. Instead, Joshua will step into that role. But God grants Moses this kind of sneak peek on the promised land. He takes him to the mountaintop and allows him to see into the promised land. And as Moses overlooks the promised land, here's what he says to God in Numbers 27. May the Lord, the God who gives breath to all living things, appoint someone over this community to go out and come in before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in so that, here's the language, the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. Moses' words, Numbers 27, overlooking the promised land, transitioning to Joshua. And so from that, in Jewish tradition, this metaphor was a common figure of speech for a strong leader like Moses, or for a kind of military warrior like Joshua. In other words, when Jesus looks on this crowd, he looks on these people, and again, if we're thinking in terms of like zealots and freedom fighters, when Jesus looks on these people, he sees a people that are without direction, without purpose, people without a leader, people who need a faithful shepherd to care for them, to nurture them, to lead them, and his heart is filled with compassion for them. A purposeless people, directionless people. You see, Jesus and the disciples see crowds very differently, don't they? The disciples view crowds as an opportunity to advance kind of their self-centered agenda, to garner attention. Jesus, on the other hand, is filled with compassion when he sees this crowd. That his go-to is compassion. That he is eager to display, show compassion. Even in moments of interruption, even when they are a nuisance and standing in the way of his cross-focused mission, his heart is filled with compassion because that's the type of Savior that we worship and serve. Filled with compassion and mercy and grace and forgiveness. So how does Jesus respond? Filled with compassion. I love that Jesus responds by teaching and teaching and more teaching and teaching and teaching and teaching until what? Sun's going down. I mean, you guys think you have it bad because I preach like 40 minutes. I mean, Jesus teaches until the sun goes down. Okay, so sign up for that on your app. We're going to have a Sunday. I just start in the morning and preach till the sun goes down. How many of you are on board? Stop. Put your hands down. You're not buying any favors. Jesus is going to teach and teach and teach and teach until it grows late. Look at verse 35. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. That makes sense. The remoteness of their location, the size of this crowd, this pending darkness. The disciples have valid concerns here. The crowd is tired. They're hungry. They are a long way from home. Like, this is a recipe for crankiness, right? They are hangry. You know that phrase? You're mad because you're hungry and tired. Hangry. Any hangry people in here today? You will be by the time we're done. This is a hangry crowd. Their suggestion seems reasonable. Jesus, send them home. Let them fend for themselves. This is one of those instances, like if you've ever attended a massive conference and they're like, all right, we're going to take a lunch break and we'll meet back at 2 o'clock, so go find yourselves lunch and come back at 2 o'clock. I remember Zach and Lindsay here today. They went to the Passion Conference last year, which is a massive young adult conference that takes place every year in first of the year. And they had the lunch break. And so there's like, I don't know how many are there, like 25 or 30,000 people at least. And so it's like, here's the six tiny vendors that you can choose from to eat lunch. And they got to the point where they were so desperate for food that and all these restaurants are out of food. So like the only thing we have left are crackers, and the crackers will be $19, right? So it's like that situation. They were hangry people that were ready to leave. But that's kind of what I picture here with the disciples. It's like, let them go home and eat. Let's take the lunch break. If they want to come back for the teaching tomorrow, they can come back. But right now, we need to send them away. How does Jesus respond? We know, we've heard this story, we read it earlier, but he answered, you give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. And they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii? This is a year's worth of wages, worth of bread, and give it to them to eat, right? Rather than confirming their concern, Jesus saying, you're right, let's send them home. Jesus says, right? Jesus counters by saying, you feed them. Let's be honest. This command seems impossible. The disciples say this will require a year's worth of wages to feed this type of crowd. The disciples have experienced and participated in the miraculous inbreaking of God's kingdom. They just got back from being on mission. They have watched Jesus do miraculous things. They have watched it and experienced it firsthand. But in this moment, they're only focused on the problem. And we kind of get it. We understand why. But think about what they have experienced with Jesus, what they have watched Jesus do, what they have experienced in their own ministry just in the previous episode. But in this moment, all they see is the problem. It's fair. The disciples have a legitimate concern. No rest, big crowd, little food, no money. Jesus has told them in his mission, like, you're not taking money with you, right? Hungry people, from a human perspective, the issue at hand and the resolution suggested by Jesus do not seem sensible. From a human perspective. But for those who live under the rule and reign of the King, those who live in the rule and reign of the kingdom that has invaded earth, those who, we'll use language we've been using recently, those who have eyes to see, those who have ears to hear, recognize impossible odds are his specialty. Verse 38. I love how everything hinges on Jesus here. He said to them, how many loaves do you have? How many loaves do you have? Go and see. When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. We know from the other gospel writers that this was a young boy that brought a lunch. He commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. We don't have time to dive into this, but you can kind of see here, if we're going with this idea that these were probably freedom fighters, zealots in the desert, Jesus divides them into companies, right? Sit down, 100, 50. This was language that they were used to, right? Get the troops together. Everything hinges on Jesus. The disciples are focused on what they do not have. Jesus focuses on what they do have. You see, the problem will not be solved by something beyond what they have. It will be resolved by what they do have. Jesus sees possibility where the disciples only see impossibility. 5 bread, 2 fish. And I'm going to guess here the 2 fish are catfish. Anybody with me? Right? 5 bread, 2 fish. 5,000 at a minimum, plus people. More than enough, Jesus says. 5 bread, 2 fish, more than enough. 41. Notice the sequence here. It's important. We'll circle back to it. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, look what happens. He looked up to heaven, said a blessing. He broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. Again, we're going to come back to this, but picture it. After seating them in these groups, Jesus blesses the bread, breaks the bread, gives to the disciples to distribute. I love how he involves the disciples here. In this slow, methodical, break the bread, distribute the bread process, he involves the disciples. He does not dismiss them. He does not rebuke them. He does not say, "Are you guys ever going to get it?" Right? He does not say, "You remember what just happened when you were in the villages casting out demons, healing people, right? Preaching the kingdom." He doesn't take them back to that. He simply involves them. And what does he involve them in? He involves them in bread distribution. Like, what kind of revolution is this, right? Sits them down and distributes the bread. Tim Keller makes the point here that if this is a revolution going on of a military nature, that Jesus exchanges their swords for sardines. Like, what kind of revolution is this? This is bread distribution. This is sit down in companies and I'm going to feed you. What is the revolution here? And look what happens, 42. We heard it, read it. And they all ate. Not only did they eat, but they were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000. There's our emphasis again, 5,000 men. We don't have time to get into kind of Jewish protocol here about only preparing what you're supposed to eat and not wasting anything. It's a whole different storyline here that Jesus is fulfilling the Old Testament in that regard. But the text is very clear that all eat, all are satisfied, and there are leftovers. More than enough. And the picture here is this relaxed, refreshing, restful, abundant feast. Not quite the revolution that they were anticipating or hoping for. Not grab your swords, let's go conquer Rome. Sets them, breaks the bread, blesses the bread, breaks the bread, distributes one person, one disciple at a time, person by person by person. A slow, methodical process until they have all eaten, all are satisfied, and they have leftovers. What a stark contrast between this desert banquet and the banquet we saw last week. Herod's palace, sensual dancing. I'll give you anything you want because I've been aroused. I'll take John the head of John the Baptist. What a different banquet is taking place. The Jesus banquet is in the open air in the rolling hills of Galilee. Herod throws a party in a banquet hall in a palace. Jesus works among the common people. We read the story of Herod. It's like only the important people show up at my party. All the rulers, those in charge, they were invited to Herod's party. Jesus is filled with compassion and he ministers to the needs of the people. Herod is self-serving, right? Focuses on his own needs and it costs John the Baptist his head. The banquet that Jesus gives is life-giving. It is satisfaction, it is fulfillment. Herod's banquet was harm, hurt, destruction, death. The banquet of Jesus in the desert foreshadows the Lord's Supper. It foreshadows the final banquet when we will all gather for the marriage feast of the Lamb. Herod's banquet foreshadows the crucifixion of Jesus. It foreshadows the martyrdom of men, women, boys, and girls that would give their lives for Jesus through 2,000 plus years of church history. What a contrast in banquets. The banquet of life and the banquet of death. You see, Jesus is a different type of king, isn't he? He's not the type of revolutionary that they were expecting or wanting. He will not march to the warring drumbeat of the zealots. He's not a freedom fighter looking to overthrow the Romans. What he is a better king. What he is a greater king. He is greater than Herod. He's greater than Moses. He's greater than Joshua. He's greater than David. He's greater than Caesar himself. His kingdom brings hope and life, not destruction and death. He is a king who is filled with compassion. He is a good shepherd who calls his sheep by name and then lays down his life for them. He is the bread of life who satisfies spiritually hungry souls. He is the better king. He is the greater king. So, a few thoughts here. Never assess life's difficulties in light of your own resources. Never assess life's difficulties in light of your own resources. Man, there's a huge problem in this text, right? There's thousands of hungry people. And if they're revolutionaries, like, you don't want to tick these zealots off, right? Thousands of hungry people and a few morsels of food. You ever been in that situation? Our tendency in that situation is, I'll get mine. You want to see it played out? Go to a buffet, right? Go to a pizza buffet at lunch with a restaurant full of people and very few pizzas out. And everybody's waiting for it to bring the next hot pizza from the back. And what happens? Pizza comes out, and if you're me, it's like, then I'm up there with the fresh pizza, even though there's 25 people waiting, I'm taking at least half the pizza. Are you with me on this? This is our tendency. When there's a lot of us and a few of these things, the tendency in our sinful natures is, I'll get mine, no matter what happens with anyone else's. Jesus uses this moment to teach us a lesson on where are we putting our trust? Where are we placing our trust? Are we trusting our resources, our abilities, or are we trusting and resting in the one who feeds crowds with morsels? Are we focused on the how, or are we focused on the who? Big difference. Am I focused on the hows of life? How am I going to pull this off? How are we going to do this? How are we going to make this work? Or am I focused on the who? Am I focused on the one? Am I focused on the king, the provider? The disciples have legitimate concerns, don't they? They have legitimate questions. I identify with that. I identify with small resources for a big problem. You ever felt that way? You ever felt that way in life? Like, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off. The issue, the problem, the struggle seems really big, and I'm not sure that my resources measure up to what I need here. You ever felt that way in life? You ever felt that way about your future? Seems daunting, seems intimidating. I'm not sure that I have the ability or the giftedness to do this. You ever felt that way in your marriage? Man, we're struggling, we're hurting. How did we get here? I'm not sure either one of us have the resources to have a healthy and happy and whole marriage. You ever been there in your relationships? You ever been there in your finances? I wasn't expecting this or this or this to happen. How are we ever going to pull that off? You ever been there in your parenting? Like, we're raising kids in a tough time, aren't we? You ever looked at the kid and thought, I'm not sure I can get them from here to here and be confident when they get here? My resources are so limited. I feel like I spent half of my oldest child, Kaylee's, childhood just apologizing to her, like, I'm sorry, like, this is the first time I've done this, right? Like, I'm so, like your sister and brother and then little brother, I'm just going to tell you, they're one up on you because I've already been through it now multiple times. I get some stuff now I didn't get them, but I am just so sorry for number one, how I was trying to pull all these things off and I was just clueless, right? It's not always in the book. You ever felt that way in life, in our parenting, in our job? In so many ways, I see what's in front of me and I'm just not sure I have the resources. But we do not evaluate life's difficulties in light of our own resources. Why? Because if we look at life's problems through human eyes, we can only see what humans can do. We only see human solutions. How is a legitimate question from this perspective? But as Jesus followers, we are not limited to our resources. Our God feeds multitudes with 5 loaves and 2 fish. We are so much like the disciples in this text. The disciples have been with Jesus for 2+ years, and yet they still have this defective, limited view of who He is because they can't see beyond their own resources. I'll speak for me here. I have a tendency to underestimate the provision of God, to underestimate the ability of God. Here's a big one. I have a tendency to underestimate His desire to help me, His child. I underestimate it. I feel like I'm a burden to Him. Why would He want to deal with this in my life? I mean, He's like got the whole world going on, right? And we tend to underestimate His deep compassion and desires to help His children. The correct answer to the "what do you have" question in the text when Jesus says, "What do we have to work with," right? The correct answer to the "what do you have" question is not much, Jesus. We don't have much, but what we do have is You. That's the correct answer. We don't have much, but what we do have is You. Never assess difficulties in light of our own resources. What about this? God often uses the small and the insignificant to accomplish the great. God often, most often, I would say, uses the small and insignificant to accomplish the great. I love what Jesus does here. He uses a sack lunch. And don't forget this part, struggling, doubtful disciples to work a miracle. And the miracle here is not some kind of like bread from heaven, Harry Potter wizard kind of way, is it, right? It's not like Jesus walking around the crowd be like, you get bread and you get bread and you get bread and just bread falling from heaven. That's not the miracle. Did Jesus have the ability to do that? Absolutely. But what does He do here? He doesn't go all Oprah, like, you get bread, you get bread. He does it through bread distribution. Divide them up. Sit them in companies. And feed them. One person at a time. It'd be like the disciples had to be like, where is this bread coming from, right? The small, the common. One serving at a time. One person at a time. the small, the common, one small serving at a time until all eat, all are satisfied. He does not skate by. It's not at the end the disciples are like, barely had enough. Last piece of bread, last person. Oh, Jesus is like, gather up the leftovers. Which reminds us of kind of the next thing I want to leave you with here. God is an abundant provider, isn't he? He is an abundant provider. There's leftovers. What did they do with these leftovers? I'm guessing they took them and made them into a casserole for Friday at the house. What does he do with these leftovers? Well, he does more than enough. Paul says he lavishes grace on us. Love that word. He lavishes grace on us. He is an abundant provider. What he provides and offers is more than enough. The gospel says it is abundant, eternal life. So I want to encourage you, follower of Jesus today, look beyond your situation to the solution. Look to Jesus. He is enough. And we respond to Jesus by offering what we have. And I want to tell you, it may not seem like a lot, but it's what Jesus wants. You say, Devin, you don't understand. All I have is a broken heart. All I have are wounds. All I have are hurts. All I have is a depressed and discouraged soul. All I have are limited resources. All I have are insecurities. You say, Devin, I have nothing to bring. I have absolutely nothing to bring to the table. That's the beauty of the gospel. Right? That we are broken and wounded and hurting and desperate people who need the good news of the gospel. That we bring nothing to the table when all is said and done. It's not Jesus trying to figure out, do you have enough faith? Do you have enough repentance? Do you have enough of these things? Have you kept the list good enough? All right, now you're welcome in. No, the gospel is we bring nothing to the table. And Jesus meets us right there. He brings everything and we bring nothing. That's the glory of the gospel. So whatever it is you have today, if it's wounds or hurt or betrayal or limited resources, we offer it to our good and gracious King, because at the end of the day, it's about Him. Our tendency in this story, particularly with the other gospels, we love to make it about the kid, right, who brings his lunch, or we love to make it about the disciples. The story's about Jesus, that whatever we bring, He takes it, He multiplies it, He turns nothing into everything. Now, let me circle back as we end. 41 and 42, I want to circle back to it because I don't want you to miss this redemptive flow in this text. Taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people, and he divided the fish among them, and they all ate and were satisfied. So when we circle back to 41 and 42, we realize the story is pointing forward. It's pointing forward even in Mark's gospel to chapter 14, where Jesus gathered his disciples the night before his death. And here's the language we find in Mark 14. He took bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, and he gave it to them and said, take, this is my body. You see what's going on in this story? Blessed, broke, gave. Blessed, broke, gave. This is the redemptive pattern of the life and ministry of Jesus. We see it on the cross, right? We see it on the cross. Blessed, Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. We see it on the cross, right? Blessed, broke, that his body was broken for our sin. His body was wounded for our transgressions, a broken body. We see it on the cross as he declares for all of eternity, it is accomplished, it is finished, it is over. Everything has been accomplished in order for the gift of eternal life to be granted through his death and resurrection. Blessed, broke, gave. This pattern is how we participate in this kingdom movement. Jesus says in John 6, we read it, eat my flesh, drink my blood. Jesus says in John's rendition, eat my flesh, drink my blood. In other words, we embrace who he is. We come to him. We look to him and believe. We turn from sin and we live under his rule and reign. We partake in his grace. Bless, break, give. And when we embrace this redemptive provision, this redemptive pattern, it becomes a part of our life rhythm. Think about it. Think about what the New Testament teaches. Think about bless. We forgive others. Why? Because we have been forgiven, right? We show grace because of the grace we have received. We love because why? He first loved us. We are called into this life rhythm of blessing because we've been blessed. Think about this idea of brokenness or breaking. What that means for the follower of Jesus living under the rule and reign of who Jesus is that we resist this constant push that we find in the disciples, that we find in our own lives, this constant push in our American culture toward individualism that says what? Fend for yourself. What do the disciples say? Send them home, Jesus. Let them fend for themselves. That's our culture. This constant push toward individualism, as long as I get mine, right? As long as I'm happy, as long as my needs are met. This push toward constant individualism and the living under the rule and reign of Jesus breaks that. It says it's not about you. It is about him. It is about those around you. What about this constant push toward consumerism? That's our culture, right? That's our social media. That's our news. That's our coworkers. That's the pressure that we live on day in, day out. That is about my desires, my wants, my comfort. And the cycle of the gospel breaks that. It's not about you. It is about being broken because because he was broken for you. So what that means is we give up power as followers of Jesus. We give up control. As followers of Jesus, we relinquish our rights for the sake of others. We step into the interruptions of life with compassion, mercy, and grace. And so I pause right here to really challenge our men. Step into this space. Step into this space. As you lead your home, you do so from a broken humility. It's not about making the next dollar. It's not about the next promotion. It's not about working 16 hours a day while my family stays home. It is about being broken in who you are, to give up, to relinquish, to sacrifice. We love as Jesus loved the church. What does that represent? A brokenness and a sacrifice that pushes toward life, eternal life. Bless, broke, give. Like, what does that look like for those living under the rule and reign? We bless others through giving, right? Through giving our time, giving our money, giving our talents, giving our energy. Bless, break, give. Now, think about how it reverses that, right? When we give this redemptive pattern of following Jesus, what happens? I give because it breaks things, right? I give my money because it breaks the power of greed over me. I give my time because it breaks the grip of individualism in my life. I give my energy and serve because it breaks the idea of consumerism in my life. I give in order to break things in my life, to break the grip of those things that are constantly pulling me away from Jesus and toward me. And so I give in order to break those things in my life. And what happens when I break? When I break those things in my life, it creates this blessing for those who are being given to, right? So when I give of myself, I am breaking that grip in my life, and I'm enabling and using other people in my life. I'm building them up and blessing them. And so this is the redemptive pattern that flows from bless, break, give. And by giving, I am breaking those things in my life that need to be broken so that I might bless others and in return bless my own soul as I lean into who Jesus is. You see what's going on here? This pattern of redemptive flow that happens throughout Scripture. This story points forward to a moment when we gather around the Lord's table to be reminded His body was broken, His blood was shed, so that we might live as participants in this redemptive stream of the heavenly kingdom. Jesus invites us in the same story in John 6. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. And whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. What a beautiful promise of this redemptive flow that we find our satisfaction and fulfillment, right? All who eat of the bread of life find what? Satisfaction. All, the text says, were satisfied. They were fulfilled. They ate and were satisfied. As we eat of the bread of life, we find our satisfaction. We find our fulfillment, right? That the hungers, the thirst that we have is fulfilled in Jesus alone. And there is more than enough. He lavishes His grace upon us. Not only is there enough for your fulfillment, your satisfaction, your completion in Him, there is more than enough. I'm a more than enough kind of guy. I feel like I need the more than enough clause, right? I know me. I know my patterns. And I am thankful that the bread of life, the living water, says, come, come. Eat of me, drink of me, and you will be satisfied and fulfilled. And guess what? There's more than enough. There's baskets of leftover grace. He blessed the bread. He broke the bread. He gave the bread. And on participating in communion and the Lord's table, we are reminded of this story of which we are a part, right? We don't do this because it's cool and fun and like, hey, it's what we do again. We do this because we are stepping into a story that traces all the way back through redemptive history, and it lands us in moments in the life of Jesus that trace all the way back into God's Old Testament redemptive story, and this links us into that redemptive stream all the way into the moment that we stand today and participate in who He is in anticipation, Paul says, of that final day, right? That the stream will continue until we will gather around the table of God in that final resting place where we find our ultimate and final fulfillment and completion in Him. That's why Paul has such strong words about the Lord's Supper. Hey, before you do this, like, check your heart, Paul says. Be careful, because what you're stepping into is a stream of redemptive history. It's not about the bread and the wine. It's about what you're stepping into, that what Jesus, He blessed, He broke, He gave, calls us into that pattern of living. And this is a moment where we celebrate that, where we tangibly celebrate the redemptive story of Christ. So I invite you, City Church, this morning to participate As I've mentioned, we are planning in the near future to begin to offer this every single week at City Church because that's that important in the redemptive stream. I invite you to participate as we step into that stream together as sojourners on this journey, people who have been blessed and broken and give because of His brokenness for our sin.